ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Politics and diplomacy can sometimes be a family business.
But when your father survived Auschwitz, fought the communists, and went on to become the foreign minister, not once, but twice,
it might just shape your worldview and perhaps allow some forthright opinions.
Yes, on this episode, you're about to meet one of Poland's foreign ministers, and there will be some strong views expressed.
I'm Kylie Morris.
I'm Hamish McDonald. Let's go roaming. Well, we're welcoming you today to the State Parliament of New South Wales, rather salubrious surrounds, Kylie Morris. We're in the Parks Room right now, so you're going to be hearing some of the timber and decorations bouncing the audio around, but we're going to take you across to the Jubilee Room shortly, where we're going to meet Minister Bartoszewski, who's visiting Australia this week. One of what I would observe or contend, Kylie, is an increasingly frequent conga line of world leaders, foreign politicians, particularly from democracies and middle powers wanting to find common cause in this rather chaotic world.
So the conga line is people like Ursula von der Leyen, Mark Carney.
This week the Japanese Prime Minister
Japanese
as well.
The Japanese Prime Minister, yeah, and the Poles. And the reason why we're speaking to Minister Bartoszewski is, first of all, he has a particular role for the Poles in this region. But he also has been meeting with people here within government at a government level about critical minerals and future partnerships. He also, as I understand it, and I'm looking forward to speaking to him about this, has been meeting with the Jewish community within Melbourne because he is a leader of that community within Poland and has a particular responsibility there as well.
What I should say up front is you're going to hear some pretty strong views, some of which you'll agree with, some of which you won't. The other thing to keep in mind is that Poland, of all of the nations in Europe, is the one that has really been increasing defence spending. Back a year and a half ago when Radek Sikorski, the foreign minister, was on this program, he talked about their target of 6% of GDP. The Polish economy is going absolutely gangbusters and has been for some time. And they obviously sit on the eastern flank of Europe, and they're probably one of the most muscular of Europe's nations in terms of the response to Putin and the invasion of Ukraine. I think what you will hear about in this interview, and just to kind of set the scene slightly, is this big loan that the European Union has offered to Poland, and it's become a pretty big domestic issue. And this is the critical bit that you probably do need to know, is that the Prime Minister, Donald Tusk, represents a different party and a different end of the ideological spectrum to the hard right president of the country, who has tried to block this funding from going through and being received by Poland. The aim of this funding is to increase defence spending. So on the hard right of Polish politics, they do tend to be slightly more Russia-friendly or view Russia in a slightly more benign fashion. Tusk is more of that kind of Atlanticist, typical
pro-NATO,
multilateralist. And so he was previously the president. He is now the prime minister. And that particular dynamic, I think, is worth being aware of as we dive into this interview. So do you want to introduce the minister?
Yes. Władysław TFL Bartoszewski is state secretary at the Minister of Foreign Affairs of Poland. So that means he's effectively the first deputy to Radek Sikorski. He's responsible for Poland's foreign policy towards the Indo-Pacific, and he's in Sydney.
Minister Bartoszewski, welcome to Global Roaming.
Thank you for having me.
You have one of these wonderful Polish names that makes me nervous trying to pronounce it, but I'm told the full name is actually important because your father was also the foreign minister and the middle name distinguishes you.
Well, I used to use it when I first went for parliament because to be distinguished. And during the election campaign, one of the colleagues overheard two old ladies saying, oh, Bartoszewski. He seems rather fit for his age.
He's looking well.
Yeah, he's looking well.
So your full name, please, for that.
Well, my name is Władysław Teofil Bartoszewski. Teofil is one of my middle names, It used to be a pseudonym in the underground during German occupation of Poland, which my father used. So they know that.
And we will actually talk a little bit about your father, because I think it's a really interesting moment in time to reflect on his life and I guess where we're at now, particularly in Europe, but I guess in terms of the sort of global political trends and trajectories. But I want to start with why you're here, because your role is actually focused directly on the Asia-Pacific region. What is it that you see, or your country, your government sees of value here? I know you've been talking about critical minerals, but there's a broader strategic play.
Well, to be precise, I'm here for three reasons. One is that I'm head of Asia-Pacific area in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Secondly, I'm in charge of relations with Poles living abroad in the Polish diaspora. And thirdly, I'm in charge of the Polish-Jewish diaspora. So I've got, therefore I had meetings with the Holocaust Museum in Melbourne and with the Jewish community and with the Polish community in Melbourne and in Sydney and stuff, and dealing also with economic matters. But the reason I'm here in particular is because, given the strange geopolitical changes that have been happening in the last few years, we considered that our relations with in Asia Pacific, and specifically with like-minded countries of Asia Pacific, of which Australia, of course, is one, we have to realize that what's happening in Europe after the Russian aggression in Ukraine is not something which is completely unlike in Southeast Asia, because we do know about Nine Lines. We do know about South China Sea. We do know about warship incursions around Australia. We do know about tests of live ballistic missiles fired in New Zealand or around New Zealand. We are fully aware of what's happening in the Philippines and the shipping, fishing vessels and so on. So we say these areas are connected, and we have to cooperate with trying to restore some international order, because if something collapses in one area, it will certainly collapse in the other.
It's that last part that I'm quite interested in, because we seem to be getting a phenomenal number of visits from leaders, politicians from all over the world, from other democracies, all trying to find a way for middle powers, for democracies to kind of hold the line. I just wonder whether it amounts to anything meaningful.
Of course it does, because we realize that the post-World War II order is, in a sense, coming to an end, because we have people openly talking about reintroducing spheres of influence. I heard President Xi Jinping talking, we need new spheres of influence. No, we don't. And there are some other big countries are very keen on that too. And it's good for the maybe three biggest countries in the world, but it's not good for any medium size or smaller countries to be left alone. That's why all of a sudden, after very many years of trying, we signed a trade agreement with Australia as the EU. Have very close cooperation now with South Korea and Japan as well, and New Zealand, apart from Australia, because we say unless we stick together, we'll be damaged one way or another separately. So it makes lots of sense. The world, which started in 1991, it's with peace dividend, you may love not war, they said in 68, is gone. We are now having voices in Europe which say we have to move to the war economy. I remember talking to a senior German politician 3 years ago when I said, you have to start spending 3% of GDP on defense. And he said, no, we are not going to do that. And I said, if you are not going to start spending 3, you end up spending 7 or 8. And then he replied, we'll never spend that kind of money on defense. And I said, and when the Russian forces are on the Elbe River, what will you do? And said, then we will. I said, by then it'll be too late. We have to be responsible because for our defense, because if we are not. Nobody's going to help us quickly. We have to be able to withstand the Russian invasion, which we think is very likely. on one of the NATO countries in the next few years. There's dispute how many, but the common view in Europe amongst the people of the political class or people in the defense ministries is 5 years is the absolute maximum. So some say three and some say sooner. Sooner maybe not because Russians are bogged in Ukraine, they cannot do very much, but it doesn't mean they cannot do a non-kinetic hybrid invasion.
But you're saying that within 5 years, Russia will go for one of these states.
Yes, it's perfectly plausible that one of the NATO countries, very unlikely Finland, and not very likely Poland, but one of the smaller ones can be attacked one way or another, and very likely in a matter which would people hesitant to invoke Article 5 of the NATO treaty. And we are aware of that, but we are preparing for that now. That's why we increase our defense spending to 4.8%. Now with the loan we got from the EU, we are going to spend over $90 billion on defense. We are trying to increase our number of soldiers to 300,000 plus 200,000 in reserve. And is the same is happening all over Europe because we are forced to do that.
Poland has hundreds of British soldiers on its eastern borders, and the Brits Sky Sabre air defence system stationed there. You have a multinational battle group led by the Americans, and you talked about the kind of defence links between all of those states in all of your neighbours. I mean, at what point does the size of that force invite trouble from Moscow? When does defence become a problem, the level of defense become a problem?
Yeah, this is a very false argument because we have the big logistical base in southeast Poland, which supplies 95% of all aid, military and civilian, to Ukraine. That base, which had 5,000 absolutely elite American soldiers, was 82nd Airborne, then it was 101st Airborne. These are not people who parade on Sunday on a square. These are people who fly in, kill people, and fly out as the top soldiers. And I met with 20 officers from the 101st, and I was at this airport. I looked around, anti-missile missiles everywhere, Patriot batteries everywhere, and all other stuff, all kinds of surveillance. And I talked to the officers there, the American officers, and they said, this is the safest place in Poland, or the safest place in Eastern Europe. Nobody would dare to do anything here. And it's correct. The only way to stop Russia is through deterrence. You are weak, you'll get invaded. You are strong, they won't do it. Which is the least likely bordering country of Russia to be invaded? Finland. Why? Because Finns in the Winter War, 1939-1940, the war lasted 105 days, number of Russian casualties, 100,000. Finns are ready for war now. And I would not like to be a Russian soldier trying to force the border. And so, and they, therefore, the Finns understand that they will not be the first. I don't think we will be the first either, because we are now getting to the stage that we would cause serious damage to any invader. And besides, we rely completely on our allies. When we had last year, we had some 19 drones crossing the border. We had help immediately from the Netherlands, from Sweden, from Germany, from Italy, and Sasser, in other words, the American general in charge of all American forces in Europe, was on the phone nonstop. And it was a coordinated effort. And we showed the Russians that it's not worth it, because we made it quite clear. You send ballistic missiles, they were only drones. You send ballistic missiles, they'll be shot down. You dare to put the pilots in, remember Turkey.
I'm Kylie Morris, here with Hamish McDonald, and today on Global Roaming, we're speaking with Poland's Secretary of State for Foreign Affairs, Władysław Bartoszewski, in the Jubilee Room at New South Wales Parliament House. It's rather grand.
So you're moving towards 6% GDP in your defence spending. That's what Radek Sikorski told us when he was on this program. You're also talking to the French. The Prime Minister, Donald Tusk, has been talking to Macron about a sort of joint nuclear deterrence. At the same time, Donald Trump is pulling many thousands of troops out of Germany. You mention the complications of invoking Article 5 of NATO when it's a hybrid warfare scenario. When it comes to Europe and Vladimir Putin, which side is Donald Trump on?
Donald Trump is, first of all, an American president, and he has American interests at heart, most of all. And he's, however, also the U.S. is the leader of the NATO alliance, and he managed to achieve what none of the previous presidents managed to do. All the presidents, including including Biden, Obama, Clinton, and Bush, said you have to spend more money on defense.
We've heard these arguments many times.
No,
right?
But this is true, and now we do. So,
But would he come to Europe's aid? You know, if these scenarios unfold, if there is a Baltic state that's invaded by Putin, if Putin were to go for Poland, would you feel confident that Donald Trump and the United States would be there?
First of all, we do believe that Article 5 is valid, but we also have the relevant article in the EU treaty, and the our EU members would undoubtedly do that, which was demonstrated by President Macron. We do have now, and it is called Enhanced Defense and Security Treaty with France, with a certain strategic ambiguity regarding some types of weapons.
But this is a very... Your response here is really interesting, and it's really
But
telling.
Let me finish. But so when we had those drones, after that stopped, the next couple of days, President Macron sent some Rafale fighters to Poland as a gesture. And he chose a squadron, which was significant, because that is a squadron of the fighters which carries nuclear weapons. He sent a message to Russia. Think about that. Yeah. It's a, yes, I think we can rely on our allies. No, we can say we cannot defend themselves. You come and rescue us. We will have to fight, and then they will come and help, like it happened in Ukraine. Nobody thought Ukrainians can manage, and then they showed they could, and all of a sudden, everybody started helping.
It's just, this is a very interesting response, given that there was a time where Europe, members of NATO, immediately sprang to the defense of the United States when it was attacked on 9/11. I think in the years after that, any European senior serving politician like yourself would have confidently said, yes, the United States would be here to defend us if Russia did something. And that's not quite the answer you've given.
No, I think America will come to our defense, but we always assumed, maybe we didn't make it very public, we always assumed that, because it's realistically, it will not be immediate, it will not be in a week, we will have to be able to withstand an attack for a period of time before these forces can be mobilized. But that is why we are now changing the logistics, because the war is won by logistics.
Wouldn't it help you if there were plenty of American troops in Germany?
It's not an issue. Nobody is removing Rammstein, which is the biggest American base in Europe. And replicating Rammstein elsewhere would take 10 years and tens of billions, maybe $100 billion. It's a major base. And what is the most important thing is not the number of troops in Germany, and nobody is talking about removing troops from Poland, incidentally, is to have the logistics, which means NATO, after 1991, did not build a yard of pipelines to carry fuel for tanks and armored personnel vehicles beyond the East German, West German border. Now we've managed to secure the agreement that we are expanding these pipelines to the center of Poland. We don't have storage. We don't have enough fuel storage for a war. We don't have enough. We have enough fuel storage to for civilian needs, but we don't have fuel storage for war. We don't have enough warehouses or whatever storage for tanks and other heavy weaponry, because we can fly and the forces very fast, but moving heavy weaponry, it takes a long time. Now we are overcoming that. Now we, everything, every infrastructure we built in Poland has to be dual use. So the roads, the bridges, have to withstand tanks. We have to have railways to be able to transport heavy weaponry east. And every building being built now in Poland has to have a shelter in the basement. You won't get a permission to build without a shelter, be it an individual household or being a house for individuals or being a block of flats or whatever. Everybody has to have it. And this is what is becoming standard in Europe. It was a standard in Finland many years ago. Sweden is catching up fast, but now we are doing it elsewhere. So we are getting prepared. And because if we are prepared, the attack will not happen, or is very much less likely to happen. And if we can show to everybody that we can withstand the first assault, it will be like in Ukraine. As I said, Ukrainians were told they're going to have 3 days, and Americans offered Zelensky to take him out of the country. And that didn't happen. And all of a sudden, we started supply Ukrainians. And we gave Ukrainians straight away 320 tanks. Which was a substantial help, and we think that we will rely on our allies, including the Americans. We have a very long connection with the Americans. You know, it's a you have Mount Kosciuszko.
Yeah, he fought in the revolution.
He fought in the revolution, and he was a general under Washington. You know, so he knew Jefferson. He was a friend with Jefferson, late president.
There's a big statue of him in the Boston Common. It shocked me. I grew up just near Mount Kosciuszko here, and I had no idea of his involvement there. So it was, I was looking up one day and thought, why on earth is there a statue of Kosciuszko in the middle of Boston Common?
Well, if you go around the White House, in the back of the White House, there are busts of Kosciuszko and Pulaski, who died in the Battle of Savannah defending Washington. So yes, we go back there. Okay. I mean, Oprah Winfrey, you must have known
yes,
of her.
I've heard of Oprah.
She went to a school in a little town called Kosciuszko. And West Point, there's no army officer who finished West Point who doesn't know Kosciuszko, because Kosciuszko built West Point. So we do have a certain connection, which is more maybe, and put it differently. We buy arms from the United States of America. The companies which produce these arms spread among 15 states. These companies employ lots of people and bring lots of revenue. Every state has 2 senators and God knows how many congressmen. And you think there's not going to be pressure on them when the states rely very much on arms production, which was dead until recently. And we are the biggest recipient of this. We also, Americans are now building a big nuclear power station, and they're hoping to build another, with plenty of Americans around. I mean, links, and you get interests, and Americans will protect their interests.
Minister, your father, who we were mentioning earlier, also Władysław Bartoszewski, he was Poland's foreign minister too, wasn't he, in 1995 and again in 2000. He was a national hero. He was an Auschwitz survivor, a fighter of the Warsaw Uprising, and a champion of not only Polish and German reconciliation, but also Polish and Jewish reconciliation. You have a particular focus on the Jewish population within Poland. And I know you've met with the Jewish community here in Australia, in Melbourne, the last few days. You are no doubt very aware of the terrible attacks at Bondi and the impact that has had on the Jewish community in Melbourne. What was your message for them when you met this weekend?
Well, very many of them come originally from Poland. So we had the talk about the Polish connection, and we are completely against any anti-Semitic movements, especially that now there are lots of anti-Semitism in various places in the world, covering up, pretending to be anti-Zionist. The fact is that this is an old ruse. The fact that many people do not like the policies of the current Israeli government does not give them freedom to attack the Jews all over the world, not to mention killing them, which is a horrific thing, because says the Israelis have attacked Gaza and therefore we can kill the Jews everywhere else. No, they can't. Secondly, Israelis attacked Gaza because they were attacked from Gaza. But the fact is that we are not in agreement with the government of Israel about some of the tactics used in Gaza. We think it's disproportionate, and we criticize them, and we make it quite open. They do commit war crimes, and we criticize them for that. They killed volunteers, including one Australian and one Polish. We demand that the perpetrators are not dismissed from the army, but face prosecution in court, and we are quite clear on that. At the same time, no, we do not think there is a genocide committed in Gaza, because the term means completely something different with what the people think. No, we do not approve of the marches shouting from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free, meaning from the Mediterranean to the Jordan River, there will be no Jews. No, we don't agree with that. We support the two-state solution and have recognized Palestinian Authority in 1988. But no, we will not tolerate any pro-Hamas terrorist organization nor anti-Semitic behavior in Poland.
Minister, we're about to lose the space, so we'll have to let you go. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, that was a rather robust conversation with Władysław Bartoszewski, Poland's Secretary of State at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Kylie, lots there to choose from. What is it that stood out to you?
Well, just that level of preparedness. I mean, we talk often across our episodes about the kinds of pressures that some nations are under and how they're dealing with the threat from China or the threat from Russia. And Poland is so far ahead in its thinking on this, and the sheer amount of resources now that is being dedicated toward Poland's defence, not only from inside Poland, but as the minister was detailing, you know, the 82nd Airborne, the 101st Airborne, the Brits who were there, the Dutch sending help immediately as soon as the drones appeared. The key moment for me, though, was when you asked him about relying on Donald Trump and the Americans, and he started talking about European
Macron.
States, yeah. European states. And I thought, well, it was revealing in itself, wasn't it?
I think, you know, what does strike me particularly is how robust the democratic politics of Poland has become since the fall of the Iron Curtain. You know, Radek Sikorski, when he was on this program, I mean, some of his commentary around Putin from that interview, you know, it ended up on social media and YouTube and was doing tens of millions of views because he was so firm in his, I think he was talking about intending to give Putin a bloody nose. And when we met Minister Bartoszewski today, before he came on, we were discussing that. And I think he said to you, Kylie, well, I'm a bit like Sikorski. I do like to make a point.
Yes, he was excited at the potential social media shares of some of his commentary. But that is a position of confidence to some extent, isn't it?
But it's also rooted in history, right? You know, the son of an Auschwitz survivor from a country where, you know, much of the diaspora has ended up in Israel and building Israel in the wake of the Second World War. And so aware of the historical links between Poland and the United States, the connections with us here in Australia, you know, these stories, as we saw when the King addressed Congress and dinner at the White House, these stories have meaning, and those histories do have weight and value in moments of friction, I suppose.
And I think there is a time for treading softly, certainly, but in Poland at the moment,
it is not that time.
And I think you could hear that in the kind of sharpness of his commentary and the confidence of his opinion that they are not being tested. They're already in a moment of preparing for crisis.
Yeah. global.roaming@abc.net.au is the email address. I suspect you might have some feedback on this particular episode, so please do keep it coming. Thanks to our producer, Aston Brown. Bye-bye for now.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.